Tonight on Banfield, true crime met real drama in a California courtroom today. Scott Peterson faced Lacey's family 19 years after she vanished Christmas Eve. Hear their reaction to his transfer off death row. And then, could there finally be a break in a four-year-old double murder mystery? A fake Instagram page has been linked to the killings of two girls in Delphi, Indiana. We've seen the social media bait and switch before after the Oxford school shooting and Gabby Petito's killing. But is it hurting or helping the police? And later, he's back. Alec Baldwin looking every bit his old self again, charging towards a reporter on the street. Paging the reputation doctor. It's all ahead on Banfield. Season's greetings, holiday travel, Christmas trees, and plenty of shopping. That is what most of us are up to these first few weeks of December, but not Sharon Rocha. She's Lacey Peterson's mom, and every year at this exact time, she is plunged into despair. Because this week, 19 years ago, Lacey's husband, Scott Peterson, began planning Lacey's murder. 2 weeks later, on Christmas Eve 2002, a very pregnant Lacey vanished. 4 months later, her body parts surfaced in San Francisco Bay, and so did her babies. For 6,818 days, Scott has been locked up, and Sharon had not laid eyes on him until today, when she stood before a judge who granted him a reprieve from death row. He'll serve life, no parole, instead. The judge would not allow a broadcast of the proceedings, but here is what Sharon said through tears. On December 15th, 19 years ago, 1 week from today, Ron and I had dinner at your house with you and Lacey. All the while we were there that evening, you're already planning her murder. You'd already researched where you're going to dump her body. It was clearly premeditated. There's no doubt about it. How evil you are. And that last evening was the last time I ever saw my daughter alive. Sharon ended her statement in court today by saying, there are two things that that will never change. Lacey and Connor will always be dead, and you will always be their murderer. Joining us now, in a moment, we Scott Mark Garagos, who represented Scott Peterson in his 2005 trial. He's also the co-host of the podcast Beyond a Reasonable Doubt with Adam Carolla. And also with us, former prosecutor and defense attorney Michael Cordoza, who worked on Scott's case. Court TV anchor Ted Rollins is here. He covered the case on the scene. And former prosecutor Beth Karras covered the trial for Court TV. Welcome, one and all. Michael Cordoza, I'm going to start with you because you know Scott Peterson better than anyone in this group. Were you surprised when you heard that the three Rocha family members, Lacey's brother, Lacey's sister, and Lacey's mom, all addressed the court today?
No, I was absolutely not surprised by that. The law affords them that opportunity to do that. You knew the family was going to take that opportunity, especially since they hadn't seen Scott in 19 years, and they wanted to, again, express to him how they felt about what they feel that he did to their daughter. So, no, I wasn't surprised.
So, Michael, did you see anything different in the Scott Peterson that you saw in the courtroom today than the Scott Peterson you knew 19 years ago?
Well, he looked a little bit older, I guess, like all of us do. But no, he was deadpan. There was no reaction. He was that way back when he was tried. So his affect, as the psychologists say, was flat. He didn't react to anything. And I'm sure Pat Harris, his attorney, told him, do not react to anything that happens in that courtroom. So no, that didn't surprise me. What surprised me, well, I guess it didn't surprise me, but Scott had no right legally to talk. I know Pat Harris asked the court, please let Scott address the court and address the family, because he wanted to express to them that, from what I understand, I didn't commit this murder. I understand how you feel, but I didn't commit this murder. But the judge would not allow him to do that, and I understand the reasons for that.
And there he is in court in his jumpsuit and in shackles. His hands are shackled by a chain around his waist, mostly to his side. More than likely, even though we couldn't see his feet, likely shackles around the feet as well. Beth Karas, former prosecutor and journalist forever and ever. You covered this case start to finish. For a lot of people who are watching right now, Beth, they might say, wait, hold it. Scott Peterson got a death sentence. How is he all of a sudden now getting a sentence of life, no parole? Can you give us the Reader's Digest version of how we ended up here?
Well, he's had a couple of appeals kind of on a dual track, as I understand it. And one is still before the judge to determine whether or not he's getting a new guilt phase. But the other one he prevailed at, which was to get a new sentencing trial, the sentencing phase. But rather than try him just on the death penalty, because there's still this pending issue of whether or not he's going to get a new guilt phase, the DA said, you know what, we're just going to give him life without parole after consulting with the family. A death sentence is really, for all intents and purposes, life without parole in California right now anyway, with a moratorium on death penalty. And they haven't executed anyone since 2006 in California, so he's serving a life sentence anyway. So put him in general population, let him, you know, it'll be cheaper for the taxpayers, and he's still going to spend the rest of his life in prison, assuming he doesn't get a new guilt phase. And by the way, I just want to say, if he did want to express his sentiments to the family about how he didn't kill Lacey, he's had 19 years to write to them. He didn't have to do it in a public setting. He could have just written to them.
So Ted Rollins, I want you to jump in on this as well, because this has been a case that you've also covered nonstop. And, you know, full disclosure, the three of us work together at Court TV. Michael Cardoza, I've been working on air with you for, I don't know, 20 some odd years as well. So it's a bit of a family reunion here on the air with this particular case. It's odd, though, that, you know, we find ourselves with these parallel processes, Ted, and that is that today, out went the death penalty. The Rocha family said to the prosecutors, please, you know what, just let's not have to go through another phase again. Just lock them away and throw away the key. But that's not necessarily what we could be facing in February, Ted. There's a shot here that we could have a whole brand new trial, and that the Rochas might actually have to sit through a whole new trial. Explain how we got there.
As Beth was saying, there's two tracks. There's the track that got him off of death row, which is now done. He's life without. The other track is his habeas petition. And the California Supreme Court looked at all of the different arguments they made, and there were several. And one of them stood out to the court. And the court said, you know what? Juror number 7 did lie on her jury application form. And we want you, lower court, to revisit this, to have hearings, figure this out, and make a determination on whether or not he should get a new trial. It's all going to come down to Juror 7, Rochelle Neese. Strawberry shortcake, as we called her, covering the trial. She was that one juror that stood out. And it turns out that she was not completely honest in her jury questionnaire about her exposure to crime and the fact that she was a victim of the crime. And the Supreme Court said, look into it. And that's what's going to happen in February. Now,
there she is.
Regardless of what the judge decides.
Just want to make sure everybody knew that
there
Strawberry Shortcake, there's a reason for that name. It was the hair. The hairstyle gave her that nickname all through the trial.
Yeah. And whatever the judge decides, it's going back to the California Supreme Court. The loser will take it there. But this is his shot, albeit a small one. This is his shot for a new trial.
I don't know. I kind of think it's a big shot. And I only think that because when you don't tell the truth about having been a victim of domestic violence while pregnant, which was what Lacey was, it's just that much more intense. It's that much more of a lie. It's that much more unfair.
But Ashley, it's Scott Peterson. It's still Scott Peterson.
Yep.
The judge is a human being. They live in Northern California. Cardo lives there. There's still that. He's that guy. And I don't know. I think it's a long shot.
I'm glad you said that, Ted, because Michael Cardoza, I want you to sort of weigh in on the politics of this, especially with what I'm about to read you. This was what Lacey's sister, Amy Rocha, said in court today. And her brother Brent was there speaking as well. But these were the words of Amy. And by the way, she could barely get these words out 19 years later, and she was sobbing through the whole thing. It's been 19 years, and there's not a day that doesn't go by that I don't think about my sister and the life that she could have had and the life that we could all have had with her and Connor. She never got to meet my family, and my boys will never know their aunt and cousin. There have been so many special occasions that Lacey and Connor should have been here for. It makes me sick being here today in front of you again. And I say that, Michael Cardoza, because this case has been fraught with emotion and with press headlines. And so if you are a judge in California, would you be okay being the judge that threw out this trial result?
Well, I think a better question might be, would you feel comfortable being a juror? Think about those jurors. The emotions were running high in Northern California. I believe in the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice made a bad decision when he said, let's move it from Modesto, 80 miles away, to Redwood City. Not far enough. The emotion in NorCal, Northern California, was very high. Everybody knew about it. Everybody had opinions. Think if you were on that jury and you brought back a not guilty verdict. I will tell you, you'd have to move out of this area, if not move out of the state. I think the Supreme Court made that mistake, should have sent it to Southern California, where people knew about it, but emotions weren't running that high. Ted, you know that there were people outside every day, 50, 100 people. When the verdict came back, people were cheering. It was frightening to a certain level. So why wouldn't a juror be affected by that? And that's why I say the biggest mistake here was trying it in Northern California. I'm not commenting on whether Scott is guilty or not guilty, but I'm saying he did not get a fair trial with his jurors, knowing what they did. And perhaps, even though they might say, oh, I wasn't influenced by this, baloney. How can you help but not be influenced by those people outside? Think if you were the person that, say, hung that jury, the one or two, what do you think would have happened out in public? Like I say, you better move out of state, if not out of the country.
Well, it's getting harder and harder to be a juror these days, as we, you know, witnessed just in the last few weeks as well, with a reporter, you know, chasing after a jury van, going through a red light to find out where they were headed. Okay, I'm going to ask the three of you to stand by. Mark Garagos is the attorney who represented Scott Peterson in that first round. And right after the break, he's going to join us to talk about what he saw today and his thoughts about that man in that jumpsuit, moving off death row, and instead into a life behind bars, unless something else goes his way in a couple of months. Garagos is up next with the three guests, back in just a few minutes. Scott Peterson was found guilty of murdering his pregnant wife, Lacey, and their unborn son, Connor, and then dumping them into the San Francisco Bay. It was Christmas Eve, 2002, 19 years ago, pretty much now. The bodies washed ashore 4 months later, and in March of 2005, he was sentenced to death. But today he was resentenced to life, no parole, ever. But does ever really mean ever? We're back now with attorney Michael Cardoza, Court TV anchor Ted Rollins, and former Court TV correspondent and prosecutor Beth Karras. And Mark Garagos joins us now live as well. He, of course, represented Scott the first time round. So, Mark Garagos, we're here today because the trial judge made errors in the kinds of jurors that were let go. They had responded that they weren't too happy about the death penalty, and that became unfair, and here we are, a resentencing, an agreement with the Rocha family. We don't want to go through a whole other penalty phase. Just lock them up, throw away the key. But today, your former client was stone-faced, even though the Rocha family was in apoplectic tears. And I wonder if you had any thoughts just about what you think he was thinking, sitting there, knowing that all of this is perfunctory, right? The sentence is the sentence by law. There's nothing else they can do. You're not trying to win anything in this court hearing today. But he sat there stone-faced with really no emotion. Did that surprise you, Mark?
No. I mean, look, today's hearing was, I said it before, it was kabuki theater. I mean, this was a joke. The death penalty has been set aside by the governor in this state, in California. This was a foregone conclusion, and actually, to some degree, was, I think, misleading, because there is also, besides the fact that the California Supreme Court unanimously set aside the death penalty because the prosecution allowed the trial judge to use the wrong standard. By the way, I kept telling him in real time, you can't do what you're doing. This is reversible error. And that alone should have reversed the guilt phase. But the California Supreme Court, after they reversed the penalty phase, then issued what's called an OSC, an order to show cause, that this juror should be examined. And if it's true that she lied and was not honest in getting onto the jury, that an order to show cause as to why the guilt phase should not be set aside as well. Interestingly enough, she supplied a declaration in cahoots with the prosecutors. And guess what? She's now gotten a new lawyer and they've invoked the Fifth. And so what Wow. will probably happen, she's invoked the Fifth. God knows why, because presumably she prepared that declaration in conjunction with the prosecution. But if the prosecution doesn't give her immunity, that declaration is going to get struck, and then they've got no evidence to countermand the OSC issued by the Supreme Court, and the guilt phase will get set aside, as it should, by the way.
So let me ask you something, just looking ahead to February. Today was today. He's got life, no parole. February is a whole other process, and it's based on Strawberry Shortcake. There she is on camera there. Do you foresee a possibility that that trial result is thrown out? And I'm going to give you a twofer so you can answer two at once. And if that does happen, could he get bail while they prep for a new trial?
Absolutely, I foresee the trial result getting thrown out. Frankly, because the prosecution, I think, was disingenuous, and they wanted a death penalty qualified jury in order to get law enforcement kind of predisposed jurors. It should have been thrown out on that grounds. But this grounds, which is the juror basically not being honest when she got on the jury, I think it'll be thrown out on those grounds. And yes, presumably he will get bail, which he should, because at the end of the day, there wasn't compelling evidence to find him guilty. I know that there are lots of people who don't want to hear that, but I was there. Anybody who tells you that the guilt was overwhelming or that the guilt was self-evident just doesn't know the evidence. I was there. I know it better. Probably not as well as Pat at this point, because Pat's back in the case. But I knew it at the time. I know it now. And I never thought he was guilty.
And Ted Rollins knows this case really well as well. And so, Ted, I'm going to ask you to sort of follow up on what Mark Garagos just said. He thinks that, yes, in February, after the hearing, we could see this trial result thrown out. I guarantee, and I'm just going to throw this out there, that the prosecutors will retry it. They're not going to say, well, what's the point? They'll retry the case. But my question to you, Ted Rollins, with all that you know, and it's more than anyone else on this case other than maybe the lawyers, do you think he can win a retrial?
Absolutely. It's possible to win a retrial because, as Mark said, if you sat through the entire case and you put, I mean, there's compelling evidence for guilt. Absolutely. That's for sure. I mean, the fact of where the bodies were found, what he was telling Amber Fry in terms of my wife is dead, the boat, not telling anybody about that. You see how the jury got there. But if you sat through the entire trial and you asked all of the questions that were coming up, there are things that are head scratchers. And does he have a chance if he gets a new trial? Absolutely, he has a very good chance of being found not guilty or a hung jury, because it wasn't cut and dry. If you got into the weeds of this case, which most people did not get past Amber Fry, they couldn't. I don't blame them.
Yeah. It was hard. That was hard to get past Amber Fry. It looked very compelling, as in many cases we cover, like Casey Anthony. It's hard to get past, I don't know where my daughter is for a month. So, Beth Karras, I'm going to put the same question to you, because I think you feel differently. Could he win a not guilty verdict if he gets a retrial?
Look, anything is possible. I can't speak for California appellate courts, but I can tell you that New York appellate courts really frown on error in jury selection. That's why he got a new death well, a new death trial, he got LWOP, but he may get a new guilt phase. Could he be acquitted? Possibly. I will go to my grave believing in his guilt, which I believe is overwhelming. I'm opining now. I usually don't do that, but I do not think that Scott Peterson is innocent. But it is also possible that he will get convicted again if he gets a new trial. My experience, not as a trial attorney, but as a reporter at Court TV for 19 years covering retrials. Retrials do not favor a defendant. Retrials statistically end up in a conviction in cases that I covered. Maybe it's not, you know, it's anecdotal, not that significant, but I have seen very few retrials end up in acquittals. And I just want to say, most murders, let me just say one thing. Most murders don't happen in front of witnesses, so they are based on circumstantial evidence. Most murderers don't confess. There aren't eyewitnesses. You don't have direct evidence. So circumstantial cases can be very compelling, and I do believe that a very compelling case was put up. Take the dog scent evidence out of the case. Who cares about it? You know, there's still plenty of evidence, in my opinion.
Well, I'm going to have to get the four of us together again because the story's not over. In a couple more months, we're going to be right back at the idea of Scott Peterson walking into a courtroom and hearing whether he's got another bite at this apple. So Mark, Ted, Beth, Michael, thank you, all four of you. Much appreciated for all your wisdom and your time tonight as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Still to come, the surge of fake social media accounts after high-profile crimes. What is going on with that? They caused chaos during the Gabby Petito case and the Oxford school shooting as well. But, and here's a big one, could they actually be helping to solve a double murder in Indiana? A surprise revelation in a double murder mystery that has bewildered investigators for 4 years. Police in Delphi, Indiana, have been chasing the murder case of two young girls, Abigail Williams, 13 years old, and Liberty German, 14. Abby and Libby, as they're known, disappeared while on a hike and were both found dead in a ravine the next day. But police now say they're looking closely at a man who's behind a fake social media account that may be connected to this case. His name is Keegan Klein. He's 27 years old, and he's facing 30 child pornography charges, including child exploitation and possession. But those charges are connected to other cases. He's currently in jail awaiting trial in Miami County, Indiana. Klein admitted to police that he used social media accounts to talk to underage girls. He said he would find girls on Instagram and then switch them over to Snapchat. He was arrested by Indiana State Police shortly after Abby and Libby were killed in February of 2017. But it turns out Klein had been using this fake account in both 2016 and 2017. The account used the fake name Anthony_shots, and it featured the stolen image of a handsome male model who was definitely not Klein. The charges make no mention of the Delphi murders, and the police have yet to say why they think this account and Klein may be connected to Abby and Libby. I'm joined now by Andrew Iden, the producer and co-host of HLN's hugely popular podcast, Down the Hill, the Delphi Murders. He's been following this investigation longer than almost anyone. Full disclosure, Andrew, Drew to me, and I were colleagues at CNN and HLN. It's great to see you. Thanks for doing this,
Andrew.
Good to
see you too, Ashley. How are you?
Well, I'm great until this happened today because I was scratching my head all day. And I thought if anyone knows the answers to this sort of confounding development, it would be you. But something tells me even you are going to be confounded by this.
Yeah, I wish I could provide a definitive answer for you here, but like you, I, as well as the other folks at our podcast, we are scratching our heads too and trying to figure out where the link is here with Keegan Klein, with this Anthony Schatz Instagram account or social media account, and any relation to Abby and Libby. And, you know, we've gone back and looked and dug through all of our notes and, you know, had endless discussions and still we're not yet able to figure out where that connection is.
So the only thing I can think of, Andrew, is this Keegan Klein, you know, imposter guy had this handsome model out there, was, you know, reaching out to kids like Abby and Libby, young underage girls in the area. Geographically, he's right there. And he was doing it in 2017 when these girls went off for a hike. And throughout this whole story, because I've covered it with you, we started this back in 2017. Sure. I kept thinking, why were those girls out on that weird kind of hike? But if they were going to meet this guy, you know, of course, it's not that guy. This model's image was stolen. Right. And, you know, instead, the girls were fished. Then I could understand why they'd be out on that very strange hike that day. But how does that correlate with the evidence that we do have in this case?
Well, what we do know, obviously, this case, there's a huge element of imagery and photographs from the jump. We know that Libby did engage on social media that day. In fact, the two photos that, you know, emerged from her phone, the photo of Abby on the bridge, as well as that haunting photo from the one end of the bridge, those were both posted on Snapchat. So Libby did have, you know, social media presence. Abby, we're not so sure. She wasn't as digitally savvy, but so there was some social media presence that Libby had. And obviously, I think investigators from the jump wanted to figure out who she may or may have been contacting, talking to. And obviously, that's been a point of discussion since the very beginning.
So if anybody's wondering, and you shouldn't be by now, the podcast is called Down the Hill for a very good reason. It's one of the only really solid leads in this case is this little snippet of audio that came from one of the girls' phones. And it was one of the last things that, you know, hopefully they were recording it in an emergency, and we got it. I have to play it 3 times in a row because it's so short. It's hard to understand. But if you listen carefully, you will hear what is presumed to be the killer's voice saying down the hill. So have a listen to this. So obviously that's why the podcast is called Down the Hill. Do we know at this point if they have done any voice recognition with this, you know, Keegan Klein fella to find out if maybe there's recognition there?
We don't know that. You know, I would imagine that at some point that may be part of their strategy moving forward. But at this point, yeah, we don't have any word on that yet.
Then there's this one other thing I want to play. The authorities had a press conference, and it was sort of chilling, some of the things they said, almost like, you know, like the killer could be in this very room. Let me play that for you and ask you about it on the other side.
Directly to the killer who may be in this room. We believe you are hiding in plain sight. For more than 2 years, you never thought we would shift gears to a different investigative strategy, but we have. We likely have interviewed you or someone close to you.
Okay, Andrew Iden, I never like to call a case cold, especially when it involves kids. And I know that the families have said, please never call this case cold. Did this development really just heat this case up?
Yeah. And, you know, Ashley, as you know, the folks that pay attention to this case are avid and ravenous about information. And, you know, the short answer is yes. I mean, I think, you know, since this news came out, people have been so thirsty for any new information. And when this came out, you know, my phone kind of blew up. People that I know that have been following this case were kind of, you know, thrust into action, trying to determine what any of this meant. Obviously, we're all still kind of sitting here scratching our heads trying to sort that out. But yes, I mean, this has thrust, obviously, this case back into the national conversation. So what that yields, I'm not sure. I think we're obviously all going to be waiting to see.
Okay. And you and I have to get together and hoist one because it's been a while. Thank you for doing this, Andrew. Indeed. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Ashley.
And great work on the podcast as well. I'm going to invite you back. Still to come, this kind of social media trickery was also seen in the Brian Laundrie case and the Oxford shooting investigations. Next, we're going to hear from a former FBI agent how you can spot these fakes online. Welcome back to Banfield. Indiana police may have a hot lead in what is starting to feel like a cold case. They've identified a man behind a fake social media account that's being linked to the infamous Delphi murders. 13-year-old Abigail Williams and 14-year-old Liberty German were killed while out on a hike in Delphi, Indiana. 27-year-old Keegan Klein says he used a social media profile called Anthony_shots to meet and talk to underage girls. That's the handle police say may be connected to the Delphi murders, but they are not saying how. I want to bring in Jason G. Weiss. He is a retired FBI supervisory special agent and currently a cybersecurity attorney at the law firm of Fagry, Drinker, Biddle, and Reith. Jason, thank you for being with me. I'm so keen to talk to someone like you because I know the police have to keep quiet. They can't tell us everything, but I am sort of flummoxed by this news that there's an account, there's a guy, and it's connected. Can you help me off the ledge, I guess? Why would they release that information and not give us the nexus that gets us there?
Thank you for having me, first of all. I really appreciate it. You know, that's a great question, but the problem we have with social media is its absolute lack of accountability. And when you deal, like many social media companies are headquartered out of California, where we've just passed two pretty extensive privacy laws, which make it fairly impossible for law enforcement to get information out of these companies without going through some very serious legal process. And even then, the information that people put into their social media profile doesn't have to be truthful or accurate. So for the most part, like in this particular case, you're immediately going to get a bunch of fake accounts. I've seen this happen dozens of times. Social media has value without a doubt in an investigative process, but you have to be extremely careful on how you rely on it and what information you try and get from it, because you can't count on the reliability of the information without independently verifying it.
So we've got his, you know, picture up on the screen, and it's clear we must say we do not know what his connection is, other than he's behind an account and there's a connection of the account potentially to the murders. That guy, the good-looking model, has nothing to do with it other than he was fished. His photo was stolen and used as Anthony Schatz. And Keegan Anthony Klein allegedly was the guy that stole that model's photo because maybe he didn't want to use this photo of his as his profile shot. Let me ask you this, Jason. I see why, too. Okay, so after a lot of high-profile crimes, we see this proliferation of social media accounts claiming to be someone who's a player. For instance, in the Gabby Petito story, people were launching accounts saying that they were Brian Laundrie, saying that they were Brian Laundrie's parents. In the recent Oxford, Michigan school shooting, people were launching fake social media accounts saying they were the 15-year-old shooter, even before the kid's name was announced by the police. How are we, unsuspecting Americans, supposed to figure out when it's garbage and when it's really the guy?
You know, that's a great question. Some people do it because they want the notoriety. Some people do it to try and scam fundraising. Those are very common reasons for setting up fake accounts. The biggest thing you got to look for when you're dealing with social media is you have to look at various factors. For example, is it a verified account? If it's not a verified account from at least somebody that would generally be able to verify an account, usually some type of celebrity or news figure or some kind of person. But if it's not verified, there's not a lot of reliability to it, especially as a law enforcement officer. I spent 22 years in the FBI investigating cases like this. I've worked dozens and dozens and dozens of child pornography cases. We have to be very careful with what we can rely on from social media. In this particular case, it's obviously he catfished people, trying to get people to, you know, to strike up conversations with him. The problem is people, now this person's notorious. Whether guilty or not, I don't know. But now you're going to see dozens and dozens of fake social media accounts, and it's very hard to separate the wheat from the chaff. And
probably people saying that they're Keegan Anthony Klein now, too. Like, you're right. Can I just ask you this? And I have just a minute left, but it's important. Sure. This, we're in a new age, right? We're all navigating, you know, pretty new territory when it comes to the ramifications that social media can have, especially when it comes to crime. How integral are police agencies now with social media companies, given the rise in privacy, given the different laws from state to state, but also given the police agencies creating entire divisions dedicated to social media? How is this relationship working? And I guess the better question is it working well?
It's not, in my opinion. I mean, having spent 22 years in law enforcement, most social media companies, most tech companies, I don't want to say they refuse to work with law enforcement, but they do it grudgingly because they're afraid if they're seen as cooperating with law enforcement that they'll lose a large portion of their potential audience because they won't trust the company to keep their information private. I mean, and in light of the fact that social media companies allow people to put information in without independently verifying it, you can't even rely on the information. You're hopeful you get like an IP address that you can trace back or something like that, but we have to rely heavily. And what a lot of companies have done is they stop logging, they stop saving this information, because if they don't have it, they don't have to provide it to law enforcement. And if they don't have to provide it to law enforcement, they don't have to deal with the privacy people who are terrified that if they put their information on there, that it will be turned over to law enforcement. Because generally, innocent people have nothing to hide. It's the guilty people that don't want this to happen. And they go out of their way. I mean, I guarantee you that many of these social media accounts that you see are filled with false and fake information that are basically useless to law enforcement.
It's hard to get that blue check, though, to be verified. Jason, I hope you'll come back again. You're a fountain of knowledge on this stuff, and that's what we need at this day and age. Thank you for this.
Thank you for having me.